Kia ora and welcome to Nerman's Podcast, episode 282. Today is Wednesday, June 27, 2012. This podcast is coming to you from my new desk. Yes, I finally did it. I finally got my desk situation sorted out. The same thing I have been thinking about and, well, probably obsessing about for years, truth be known. And In the end, I narrowed it down to three possibilities, an expensive one, a relatively inexpensive one, and one that was in between the two, and I went with the in-between. What I wanted basically was one that looked like a table. And although the cheapest one was a very real possibility, its main problem was that it had what's usually called a modesty screen on the back, and it went about halfway down the legs, and they did it for reinforcement because the legs are relatively thin, and otherwise it would depend on the strength of the welds to keep it together because the legs are metal. But it made it look like a desk and not a table. And so I found these other ones at a different store, and they were also on special, as it happens. And so I went and got them. Turns out that they're actually made, I believe they're made in New Zealand. It's certainly distributed by a New Zealand company called the Knight Group, which used to specialize in office seating, but now does desks and workstations and stuff like that. And the legs are steel, and they are made, the square steel, basically about the size of a 2x2. They're 50 millimeters on a side, and they're sort of in a giant U-shape, and then they're joined together by a steel box beam across the back. And the top is a very high-density fiberboard sort of thingy, as they all are, but this is extremely dense. I can tell because it's so heavy with white melamine. So it does look like a big table, like a very big table, and which is exactly what I wanted. So I got one for me and one for Nigel, and I got a mobile, you know, file drawers thingy to go with it as well, matching, because I thought, you know, I could get one somewhere else. Might even be cheaper, but it might not look right. So I thought, I'm just going to go with one that they sell with it. And so all of those were delivered on Friday of last week. And I wanted to put them together over the weekend, but just couldn't find the time to do it. So I didn't. Well, part of the thing is that I had to clear off my old desk, which was a big corner desk. It's 1800 on a side. So it's this big workstation. Calling it a desk is actually not accurate. And so I worked on that over the weekend and just left it with the bare minimum, my computer and stuff like that. And so Monday then I did that, and I took my old desk apart, which was one of the main holdups because, well, it's actually not that difficult, but it's bulky. So I took the old desk apart, moved it out of the way, and then, you know, cleaned where the old desk was. And then I assembled the new desk and put it in position. Went relatively okay, all things considered, but the desk is big. I mean, it's 1,800 long, which is, you know, better part of 2 meters, 1.8 meters long, and it's 800 deep, whereas my old desk, I think, was 65 deep or something like that. And so it's, by my standards, it's a huge desk. So I got all that done and then reassembled my computer equipment and all that stuff. And then yesterday I assembled Nigel's because I got him one exactly like mine. And I had to do the same thing in his office, move everything off his desk, take the desk, his old desk apart, put the new desk together and put it in position. But his actually went much easier, probably because I'd already done one. It's usually faster the next time. And so that's all done, and he loves his desk. And I love my desk. It's exactly what I was looking for. And now I just have to get the rest of my office organized. It's still a bit of a tip, partly because I'm reorganizing these mobiles. I try to keep stationary supplies in the drawers, but naturally other stuff got in there as well, and I've been having a rethink about how I want to do it all so that it makes more sense, really. So that's what I've been up to this week, and they have been working on our street on phone cabling. Apparently there's a fault somewhere in the cable up on the street that's affecting a lot of houses, and so they said they were going to have to dig up our driveway because there was a join underneath the drive. And they came on Monday to say that basically if we wanted to get out, we'd have to get out by 8 a.m. Well, I don't know. I thought, okay, I'll just plan projects around the house and I'll find something around the house to make, although I ended up having Nigel pick up takeaways for dinner, so I wouldn't have to worry about it. But apparently it's all fine today, so in a little while I'm going to go out and pick up some things for dinner. And that's what my exciting week this week has been all about. Well, today I'm going to tell you about some work that was done by Statistics New Zealand, which is, as the name implies, an agency that collects and collates statistical information about New Zealand. especially from the census, but not exclusively the census, also all sorts of surveys that they do throughout the year, not just the census, which is every 5 years. But first, just some items from the news. Last night, or yesterday afternoon, or whenever it was, the New Zealand Parliament finally passed the asset sale bill that the National Party government was pushing. And it won by one vote, which is exactly what the government's margin is. The government has 61 votes and the opposition has 60 votes. And so this was not an unexpected thing. Everybody knew that this was going to happen. And it's not in any way a surprise. However, there are very likely to be legal challenges. The first company that they're going to sell is a power generation company called Mighty River Power. And some of the local iwi, or Maori tribes in the central and North Island, are talking about basically suing the government because they own the riverbeds and lake beds that the power company gets its water from. And so they are looking to, I don't know, there's kids out in the park, so you just heard that was Sunny barking, of course, saying hello, as per usual. Anyway, so they are fighting. The government is saying that they may set aside shares in Mighty River Power for the iwi as part of their Treaty of Waitangi settlement. But who knows? The problem with all of this, and I don't want to go into a great bit of detail about why asset sales are wrong, but the best analogy that I've seen several versions of this analogy, but one that was put out by this guy on Twitter called @farmgeek. He is a progressive farmer, which, if you know anything about farmers in New Zealand, is pretty rare. And he tweeted that selling state assets to pay down debt is rather like a farmer selling his dairy cows in order to pay farm debt. Yeah, you get your debt down, but then how do you make your money? What are you going to make your money from? And that's basically what it is. These state-owned assets are returning more to the taxpayer in terms of profits than the debt that New Zealand owes costs. So the return on investment is higher, the profits are higher than the amount that we pay out in debt, in interest payments and so on. So basically we're giving away our cash cow in order to theoretically pay down some debt. Now, I don't for a minute think that's what it's all about. I think the whole issue here has been that the National Party fundamentally doesn't believe the government should own anything that business can own. And they would sell off everything that's not nailed down if they could get away with it. They know that they can't because most New Zealanders are opposed to these asset sales. The vast majority are opposed. But they're going ahead with it anyway, saying that they have a mandate to do so because they won the election, which is a bit odd in itself because they did win government with a cobbled-together coalition. But the parties that oppose asset sales actually got more votes when you add it all together. Not a huge amount more. But since then, of course, all of the public opinion polls are showing that New Zealanders oppose these asset sales by huge margins. So I don't know if this is going to come back to haunt them in the next elections. I'd like to think it would, but I'm not so sure. Because people tend to forget things. You know, what do they say, that the length of memory of any political issue is 6 months or something like that? And the next election isn't until 2014, so who knows? I don't know if people are going to remember any of this by then. But related to that, it was in the news today that KiwiRail, which owns the rail company in New Zealand and also the Inter-Islander Ferries, is writing down its value, the value on the books, from $7.8 billion to $1.3 billion. There's a range there for some reason. And they're going to separate the rail and ferry operations from the land holdings. Now, the allegation is that it was never worth $7.8 billion in the first place, but they were saying that it was for who knows why. The government bought KiwiRail from Toll Holdings for $600-odd million. This is during the last Labor government, $690 million. This was during the closing year or so of the last Labor government. And at the time, it was alleged that they paid too much for it. Well, whatever. It's worth more now than it was then, so does it really matter if they paid too much? The problem is that under successive owners, they've been basically stripping the profits out of out of the rail system and shipping them overseas. When I moved to New Zealand, it's called Transrail in those days, T-R-A-N-Z. It was owned by Wisconsin Rail. And later on, it ended up in Australia's Toll Holdings. And they were just taking all the profits out. They weren't reinvesting anything. They weren't strengthening and extending track or anything like that. They weren't upgrading the rolling stock. They weren't doing anything that they didn't have to do at a minimum. It would just repair things as they broke, and that was about all they would do. So when the government finally bought it over, it was really in a shambles. And so it took a lot of investment in order to get things right again. By separating off the land, which is basically all the land that the tracks run over and all that sort of stuff, what the government is doing is they're setting up Kiwi Rail to be sold off, because what the other operation, if you will be about transport and shipping by train and so on, and that could be sold off to foreigners, and the government could retain the land. Now, it's never worked in private ownership. Why they think it's going to suddenly work now is beyond me, except again, it gets back to nationals' bias that government should never own anything. So, I don't know, that's clearly what they're working up toward, but not in this term, because this term they're only planning on selling off energy companies. And one of the reasons why energy company sales is a big deal is because the last time National was in power, they privatized, in quote marks, energy companies, which means they sold them off to foreigners, basically, several of them. And all of the profits now go overseas. None of them stay in New Zealand. The few New Zealanders who got shares sold them fairly quickly, and so it's now foreign-owned, these companies. And that's when prices for power, for electricity in New Zealand, started skyrocketing, was after National reformed, in quote marks, the electricity sector. And so it's only going to get worse. We're going to see power prices skyrocket now as these companies are sold off, because they have no incentive to do anything that helps New Zealand. Their only incentive will be to make a profit for overseas shareholders. Because although the government says that it's going to be sold to mum and dad investors, even though mum and dad New Zealanders already own these power companies as New Zealanders, putting that aside, the minimum share purchase will be $1,000 per company. And average people just don't have that kind of money sitting around to invest in shares. So when it's not fully subscribed, they'll open it up to foreigners. And then in very short order, foreigners will end up owning a huge chunk of the company. Now, the government is retaining 51% of the shares. But as anybody who knows anything about corporate structures know, once anybody gets a sizable holding, say 10% or more, they can demand seats on the board, and that can determine what happens with the policies of the company. And if National's in power, they're not going to do anything to stand in the way of corporate decisions or corporate shareholders, even if it's bad for New Zealand. So for all of these reasons, this is just a disaster waiting to happen. On the other hand, there's some good moves, which may or may not amount to anything. The Labour Party is working to push for an extension of the provocation repeal. And what that means, longtime listeners may remember me talking about a law that used to exist on New Zealand books, where somebody could claim, it's called the partial provocation defense or something like that. I've forgotten what it used to be called. But basically, it's known in most countries as the homosexual panic defense. And the way it works is that somebody alleges that it's usually men, that a man came on to somebody and he panicked and just snapped and didn't know what he was doing and murdered the gay man. And they would then be able to get their charge reduced from murder to manslaughter, which is obviously a very much less serious deal. Well, finally, in 2009, I think it was, 2009, that defense was repealed, and it was no longer possible for somebody to claim this panic defense, or can they? Late last year, there was a trial of a man who had murdered a gay man in Papakura, and in the trial, what they tried to do was to portray this guy as some sort of predator, the victim as some sort of predator, who he was 59 at the time, and his murderer was 17. So they tried to the defense tried to portray him as an old man who fancies boys and tries to seduce them or whatever, tries to take advantage of them. And so what the point of this new bill from Labor's Charles Chevelle is to remove that possibility. They point out that you can't introduce a rape victim's history into a rape trial because the victim is not the defendant. The defendant has to prove that they didn't do it. And so why should, in a case like that, why should the defense be able to introduce things that bring into question the character of the victim? Basically make the victim responsible for their own death is what it amounts to. And so I don't know what's going to come of this. The government hasn't stated a position yet, and it would depend on two things. First, it would depend on there being a private member's bill and have it drawn from the ballot, or it has to wait for the next time Labor's in government. Surely the national government wouldn't do anything about this because they don't care about things like that. Although I believe that when this did come up, most of the caucus did vote for repeal of the Partial Defense Act. I'm not sure. I'd have to look that up. So, but that's a good move, and I would like to see that happen because that bill, I refer to it as an abhorrent law on my blog, and I would very much like to see this passed as well to close the loophole that exists. And finally, in New Zealand news, the New Zealand Department of Internal Affairs is planning on introducing more flexible passport policy for transgender and intersex people. And apparently they've been working on this for a while, but their plan is that applicants will provide a witnessed statutory declaration, which is sort of like a sworn statement, and with their passport application, saying what their circumstances are and telling them what gender identity they want displayed on their passport. And the idea, basically, is that very often people's gender, the way they present their gender does not necessarily match their birth gender. And this can, as you can imagine, causes problems for people when they're traveling. If they present at the border as a female, but their passport says that they're male, that can be a problem in some places. So this should ease that sort of thing overall. It doesn't actually have any effect on their birth certificates or citizenship records. That's covered by a different law, and they would have to go to the court to get those changed. But for passports, which is an identity document, it could actually help people quite a lot. Now, intersex people will also be able to choose, the proposal has it, between M, F, or X as their gender on the passport. So this is a very good thing. And I should say that the Department of Internal Affairs is pretty agnostic about things that some people might find controversial or whatever, because that's not what their interest is. Their interest is in providing documentation for New Zealand citizens. They're responsible for recording births, deaths, and marriages, and citizenship, and so on. And so they're not really concerned about the things that some people get so worked up about. They're just concerned in making sure that basically Kiwis can get on with their lives, what it amounts to. So, no, this is a really good thing. I wouldn't necessarily have expected it to happen during this government. But anyway, but it's a good thing. We'll see. If I hear more about that down the road, I'll certainly mention that. But the main thing I wanted to talk about today was this week, the Statistics New Zealand released a, I don't know what you call it exactly, it's part of the website. But they call it Population Mythbusters. And what they do is they look at a whole bunch of myths about New Zealand and talk about them, say, what does the evidence really show? Now, of course, I have so much trouble saying that word. Statistics New Zealand keeps track of all the information about New Zealanders, not the census, the next one. Oh, by the way, the next one is in March of 2013. I'm sure I've forgotten to mention that. It's been rescheduled for March of this coming year. So we will get our census finally. But there's a lot of interesting things that they talk about, some of which is stuff that most of us probably would never even think of asking about. But some of them are probably things that that people overseas would think or would hear. And so I thought it might be kind of fun to go over a list as the New Zealand Herald prepared it. But I'm also going to provide a link to the actual site on the Statistics New Zealand website so that you can, if you're really keen, you can delve more deeply into the statistics that underlay, whatever, all of this. But there's a few things that they didn't mention in any great detail in this particular quiz, so I thought I might take a minute or two and just talk about them. They talked about there's a number of people who say that just before the Christchurch earthquakes, Christchurch had become New Zealand's second biggest city, replacing Wellington. And their conclusion basically is that it's a matter of semantics. It depends on what you're talking about, because there are there's a number of ways of looking at it. And what it basically boils down to is how you define a city. Because if you talk about just, if you talk about the territorial authority, the area that's governed by Wellington City Council, and you talk about the area that is governed by the Christchurch City Council, then Christchurch City Council is far and away larger than Wellington. But not only that, Wellington, as of the end of 2009 anyway, was only the sixth largest city in New Zealand. The four cities in Auckland were all bigger than Wellington. And so together with Christchurch, they made up the top five cities, and Wellington was in sixth place. But if you use a measure that they call urban areas, I think it is, or urban, yeah, I think it's urban areas, for Statistics New Zealand, then they're very similar, Christchurch and Wellington. This is before the earthquakes. Since then, of course, Christchurch has lost quite a bit of population and is, well, actually, we're not quite sure where it is at the moment because we don't have a census. But it is certain that they have lost population, partly because there's also a housing shortage in Christchurch. Rents have skyrocketed. Property values haven't appreciated very much, apparently. But yes. So, but there's another myth related to population, that the number of New Zealanders who returned home overseas surged because of 9/11. And that's not exactly true. It's partially true, but not necessarily because of 9/11. What they point out is that, yes, there was an increase of New Zealand citizens returning home from September of 2001 onwards. But what's also true is that a few years beforehand, there was a similar surge of people leaving New Zealand to go overseas. And very often, an OE, or overseas experience time, could be 2 or 3 years. And so it's entirely possible that these are people who would have returned home anyway. And there's no way of knowing for sure, because it's not like they were asked when they came home, why are you home? So it's one of those could be true sorts of things. But here are some things that the New Zealand Herald listed, and they listed them as fact or fiction. And so I'm just going to read them as a statement, and then I'll give you a second to decide for yourself whether this is fact or fiction. And by the way, there's some of both, so you can't assume anything. New Zealand has 3 million people and 60 million sheep. Fiction. Sheep numbers peaked at 70.3 million in 1982 when we had 3.2 million people, but we now have only 31.1 million sheep and 4.4 million people. So it's not even close. But the funny little thing about that, when I first came to New Zealand, there were roughly 13 sheep for every human in New Zealand. And a couple of years later, it had dropped to 11 sheep per human in New Zealand. And I was saying around to people, who took two of my sheep? I actually haven't worked that. I should do the maths, but I can't be bothered right now. For how many sheep per person? More women are remaining childless. More New Zealand women are remaining childless. Fact. The proportion of women aged 45 to 49 years who were childless has risen from 9% in 1981 to 13% in 2006, which I think mirrors a trend throughout the developed world, actually. New Zealand is in the middle of a baby boom. Fiction. The average number of children each woman can expect in her lifetime fell from 4.3 in 1961. 4.3? Jeez! In 1961 to less than 2 around the year 2000. It rose slightly to 2.18 in 2008, but by March this year, it was 2.04. So basically, statistically, that's not much difference from 2000 onwards. So it is fiction. New Zealand women have their first child at age 30. Fiction. The median age for women giving birth last year was 30, but the median age for having first child was around 28. Now, of course, to me that seems a bit of semantics, but anyway. Almost half of all Kiwis will soon be non-European. Fiction. And this is one you hear a lot. Fiction. By 2026, 16% will be Maori, 16% Asian, and 10% Pacific, but 70% will still be European or mixed race. And that's actually an interesting statistic, because one of the reasons why this is so, why so many people believe this is because they hear that 52% will be of European descent, and 48% will be non-European ancestry. So they think, oh my God, almost half of these people are going to be of non-European ancestry, except that about 12% of the population will actually be of mixed race, including European. So if you take all the people who have European ancestry of any sort, that is where that 70% comes from, and which is completely different from saying almost half of Kiwis will be non-European. It all depends on how you look at the statistics, and it's because the people of mixed race were counted twice, and it can be a real problem. But interestingly, the group that is least likely to have interracial children, is what it amounts to, are Asians, because about three-quarters of them have Asian children, and only about a quarter have non-Asian children, whereas with the other races, Maori, Pacific Islanders, and so on, it tends to be a little bit more mixed, according to Statistics New Zealand. Where did I leave off? Oh, the average woman lives 6 years longer than the average man. Fiction. While true in the 1980s, the gap has closed 3.7 years. On current death rates, a baby born today can expect to live 79.1 years, and a baby girl, 82.8 years. So there's not as nearly as much difference as there used to be. And the interesting thing that I saw recently was they were talking about how by 2020, I think it is, that the number of people who are 100 years old or older, sorry, 2050, will be starting to dramatically increase. Now, here's the thing. They were talking about kids born now and how they can, many more of them will be able to expect to live to be 100. But I'm thinking that in 50 years, those kids are not yet going to be 100. They're all kids born now will only be 50 in 50 years. So those centenarians are people from my generation. So that means that I might have a better chance of making it to 100. Who knows? Well, I like to think so anyway. Half of all marriages end in divorce. Half of all New Zealand marriages end in divorce. Fiction. There are roughly 20,000 marriages and 10,000 divorces every year, but only 35% of couples who married in 1986 divorced before the 25th anniversaries in 2011. So it depends mostly on how you frame the data. And you can't just compare the number of marriages and divorces in a year. You have to do a longitudinal study and look at what happens to the marriages that happened in a given year. And that's a lot more complicated. And it certainly doesn't make headlines. Couples tend to divorce after 7 years. Fiction. The peak divorce rate is only 4 years after marriage, and divorce becomes steadily less likely with every year after that. And what that sort of gets to is the myth of the seven-year itch and all that sort of stuff. There's a brain drain. Fiction. On average, over the past 15 years, we've lost 300 laborers a year and net losses of most other unskilled groups. But we've gained 1,570 professionals a year because of our skills-based immigration policy. And that's actually an interesting thing, because politicians on both sides have been talking about this brain drain, how we're losing our best and our brightest. But neither side ever talks about how the migration policy, which does currently favor two kinds of people, three kinds of people, the rich, the super rich, and those who have specific skills, they bring skill-based immigrants in. So it actually... The data actually shows that we don't have a brain drain. We have a people drain, perhaps, especially if you consider New Zealanders going overseas, which gets to the next one. New Zealand's population is drifting. Oh, sorry, it's the one after that. But anyway, New Zealand's population is drifting north. Fiction. A net inflow to Auckland up to 1996 has reversed. Since 2001, there's been a net outflow of people from Auckland to the rest of the country, although Auckland still gains more from overseas. And what that means basically is that people in Auckland are moving away from Auckland, but people who are moving to New Zealand move to Auckland. And that's been the case for as long as I know, because foreigners tend to settle first in Auckland. Sometimes they move elsewhere in the country, sometimes they don't. But there, from time to time, you'll hear politicians talking about how we need to have incentives to get immigrants to move to other parts of the country. And they're even talking about making their residence visas and permits and stuff contingent upon them agreeing to live in another part of the country. But nothing's ever come of that. And it's not really fair. It makes sense to offer that to people who wouldn't qualify otherwise, but would you really want them anyway? So I don't know. But yes. So, last one. At least 1 million Kiwis live overseas. And the answer from this one is maybe. They say there are 483,000 New Zealand-born people in Australia, about 58,000 New Zealand-born in Britain, and 73,000 in the rest of the world, a total of 614,000. But you could easily get to around 1 million if you count New Zealanders' children and New Zealand citizens who were not New Zealand-born. And that's actually part of the problem. I mean, I'm a New Zealand citizen who's not New Zealand-born, so it all depends on how you frame the your definitions. Which kind of reminds me of the line from Benjamin Disraeli: "There are lies, damnable lies, and statistics," or words to that effect. I can't remember the exact quote off the top of my head, but it is one of my favorites. And you have to be careful with statistics. And this is something I always say about blogs as well, that if you're going to be talking about statistics, you have to go to the original source and not trust somebody's reporting of them. Very often I've seen bloggers who will report a public opinion survey that was mentioned in a news report. And although the numbers may be accurate, it's very difficult to be able to read those numbers without also reading the interpretation of the journalist. So what I do, or try to do anyway, is to go to the original site of the study and go to what the data actually says, like Gallup, for instance, or Pew Research, or somebody like that, or in this case, Statistics New Zealand. And very often what I find interesting in those polls and studies isn't necessarily what the media is picking up on. There's something else that I think is more interesting or as interesting, and very often that's the angle I take in my blog. But my point is that it's always best to go to the original source rather than trusting anybody, including me. Shouldn't trust me necessarily. When you want information, I've referred to this on my blogs several times: trust but verify. If it's a source that you think is normally trustworthy, like say a New York Times or something, still verify it. Make sure it's actually true. In this day and age, anybody can be taken in. In this internet age, anybody can be fooled. So it's always best to go check things out for yourself. And that is my tip for the day. And that's actually related to a comment I got on the previous episode, 281, from George in Atlanta, who said, "I hope the attitudes about online friends, in quote marks, versus real friends, also in quote marks, dissipate soon. The quality of the dialogue should dictate the level of friendship, not a tactile presence. Very nice, thoughtful, honest tribute to Lord Byron." Well, thank you, George. And George was also kind enough to tweet something along those lines as well to his followers. And Timmy Sims did as well today. So thank you to Timmy as well. And thank you, George, for leaving the comment. And that is... Oh, one last thing. Actually, speaking about George reminded me. Last time I mentioned about Farpoint Radio and wasn't sure what was going on with it or something. I can't remember. And the gist of it is that last week I just decided to hell with it, and I went ahead and I renewed the license for another year. And because Nigel couldn't quite decide what he wanted to do, and I thought, I'm just going to do it. So that gives us the freedom to do whatever we want with the show and so on. So that is all sorted. It's all licensed for another year. And so that means that at some point, probably the third colony will be back. I haven't really talked to Nigel in any great detail about it at this stage. But there's already a show that started today, the Big B Radio Show, hosted by Brian, formerly of my Gay Two Cents podcast. Some of you may remember that. He started a music show. It's from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern on Tuesdays. And that's basically pop music and that sort of thing. And then also on Thursdays from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern, he does a show that's all blues music. So if you have a hankering to, check out his show on farpointradio.com. And who knows, maybe one day a third colony will return. You just don't know. Don't know these things. But that is it for today. And hopefully I will be back soon. You just never know these things. Oh, I already said that. Bye.
You can leave a comment on this or any other episode of the Amrens Podcast at amrenspodcast.com. You can send an email to me at Arthur, that's A-R-T-H-U-R, at amrenspodcast.com, or you can ring my U.S. comment line on 206-666-5172. This podcast is produced and distributed under Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.